You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, Christina was joined by AUT Professor Marcus Jones. This week, Marcus and Christina discuss a new Pfizer antiviral to fight COVID-19, the recent Glasgow Climate Pact, and how nonsense words can make us think of specific shapes.
So let's kick things off with what is probably the most topical issue, COVID-19. It's always COVID-19. So a couple of weeks ago, there was some good news from Pfizer. They've created an antiviral pill against COVID, and early trials are looking promising. So how exactly does this antiviral work?
Okay, so this is a drug that's been, yes, been introduced by Pfizer, and it's it got some really promising early test trial results, like you say, and it's a technology that's borrowed from some technologies that were successfully used for tackling the AIDS virus. And so in trials that were actually halted early because they were going so well, the company's this experimental compound slashed hospitalizations by about 89% among those treated within 3 days of their first symptom, and by nearly that much among people who started the pill within 5 days of first feeling COVID symptoms. And this Pfizer antiviral pill is called a protease inhibitor. It's a well-studied class of drugs that really is what revolutionized the fight against HIV, and they have a very well-known safety record. And this comes on the heel of other promising COVID treatments. So there was a pill, an antiviral pill from Merck, which works in a slightly different way. And that was approved by the United Kingdom last week, I believe. And if Pfizer's treatment is able to sort of join this growing number of antiviral pills, it could become a really powerful weapon to stop severe symptoms of COVID-19 and help people get over the virus more quickly. Now, the trial that was reported just a few days ago was on 1,200 unvaccinated people, and it could also help those who are vaccinated and start to suffer a breakthrough infection. And this was a surprise. The announcement of the results was a surprise because they'd only just announced that they were trialing this drug. So in the press release, Pfizer reported that just 3 out of 389 people with confirmed COVID-19, or 0.8%, who took the drug within 3 days were hospitalized, and that's compared to 27 out of 385, or more like 7%, in the placebo group. So that's quite a big difference. And 10 of those patients who got the placebo actually subsequently died, and no one who got the Pfizer pill did. Now, getting antivirals to people within 3 days of diagnosis can be a bit difficult sometimes. So there was also a study for people who started a therapy within 5 days of getting their first symptoms. And in that study, 6 out of 607, or again about 1%, were hospitalized when they were taking the pill, the treatment, and then 41 out of 612, or about 6.7 or nearly 7% in the placebo group. So the results are very similar, whether it's 3 days or 5 days. Now, in addition to being unvaccinated, every participant had at least one medical condition, like diabetes or lung disease, that put them at a higher risk of severe COVID-19. Now, the details are not fully available. It's typical for companies during this pandemic to not make the detailed data available, only the top line results. And this work has not yet been peer reviewed, but it seems very promising. Now, there's broad agreement among doctors and scientists that drugs that cripple this SARS-CoV-2 virus directly and early in an infection are really crucial to helping to end this pandemic. They are also quick to emphasize that these treatments shouldn't replace vaccines. Vaccines are really the first line of defense. But if we want multiple weapons in our arsenal against COVID, and these antiviral drugs seem to be a really important tool.
Let's turn to the other world issue that has probably been on most of our minds as well, climate change. I'm sure most of our listeners are aware of the recent COP26 climate summit, where world leaders committed to the Glasgow Climate Pact. So could you quickly run us through what that pact involves?
Yes, so this is a step forward. So the Glasgow Climate Pact is certainly a step forward, but researchers, scientists say that efforts to decarbonize aren't really enough yet to limit the global temperature rises to 2 degrees degrees Celsius. So the government ministers at this 26th United Nations Climate Change Conference of the Parties, which is what this COP26 stands for, they reached a deal recently after discussions overran by about 24 hours. And on the 13th, representatives from nearly 200 countries agreed to the final text of that deal, which pledges actions to curb emissions, more frequent updates on progress, and additional funding for low and middle income countries. Now, researchers are relieved that there was an agreement, so there was some progress, but there were some were dissatisfied at the lack of stronger commitments to reduce emissions and a failure to agree sort of a loss and damage finance for countries that are vulnerable to climate change. So it certainly closed the gap from where we are to where we really should be to keep temperature rises down. But really, researchers are saying countries need to now come forward with more ambitious pledges to tackle climate change. So just a few points. The document, the 11-page document called the Glasgow Climate Pact, said that greenhouse gas emissions must be reduced and carbon dioxide emissions must fall by 45% from 2010 levels by 2030 for global warming to be maintained at 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Now, it's noted that under existing emissions reductions pledges, this is what we have now, emissions will be nearly 14% higher by 2030 than in 2010. So instead of being 45% lower, they are currently predicted to be 14% higher, which clearly isn't going to keep us at 1.5 degrees. And for the first time in a report from one of these COP meetings, the nations agreed to begin reducing coal-fired power and to start eliminating subsidies on other fossil fuels. And note that this is often people have used carbon capture technologies on coal-fired power stations as a way of reducing carbon output, but this is actually reducing the amount of coal that's being burned. So I think that's a good step forward. However, following objections from China and India, a promise in earlier drafts of the text to phase out coal was changed to phase down coal. So there's a subtle difference there.
Now, finally, and this one is a little bit lighter, so that is nice. Random made-up words can actually make people think of the same shapes. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I thought this was quite interesting. So, in English we hear words and we associate them with shapes, or sort of we have a picture in our head about what they mean. So, if you hear the word say circle, you'll probably think of something that's round. If you hear the word razor, and you'll think of something sharp. But what about sort of nonsense words that don't really have a meaning in English? Is there a sort of a universal way of interpreting these words that sort of transcends language? So in a famous linguistic study, researchers showed that a couple of words make English speakers think of different types of shapes. So the two words that they looked at were these nonsense words. The first one was kiki, k-i-k-i, and the second word was, I guess, booba, which is b-o-u-b-a. And people in English speakers tend to think when they heard kiki, they think of sharp shapes. And if you hear the word booba, you think of blobby or rounded shapes. An earlier study found that this was true in English speakers, but a more extensive study tested 917 speakers of 25 different languages that used 10 different writing systems and found that the majority of the participants across languages associate the word booba with a blobby shape and kiki with a sharp one, even though these words they have no meaning in any of these languages. And such cross-sensory links here between speech and vision show people can actually use nonsense words and other vocal noises to evoke concepts without using actual language. And this could help us explain how language evolved in the first place. So past research has pointed to the spikiness of the letter K and the roundness of the letter B as the primary reason for the effects of those two words on English speakers, but work has found that children who haven't yet learned to read also make this association, as do, for example, the Himba people in Namibia, who have limited contact with Westerners and don't use a written language. To understand how much of a role writing plays in the finding, they tested speakers from much wider sample of languages and crucially from different writing systems. And that included speakers of languages from around the world, from Albanian to isiZulu in South Africa, and writing systems as different as Thai, Georgian, and Korean. And the researchers asked participants to choose whether a pointy sort of star-like shape or a blobby cloud-like shape best matched each sound. And the volunteers overwhelmingly matched booba with the round shape and kiki with the spiky one. This finding suggests people make a genuine link between the sounds and the shape, and it adds to a growing pile of evidence that challenges an old linguistic dogma, which is the belief that the sounds that make up a word have no relationship to its meaning. And clearly that's possibly not the case, but there were some important differences across languages, where 75% of speakers whose language which is used the Roman alphabet, including English and other European languages, make the link. Only 63% of speakers of other languages, such as Georgian and Japanese, did. And three languages, Romanian, Turkish, and Mandarin Chinese, didn't show the effect at all. And there's good reason why the findings might look different across languages. So different languages have their own rules for what sounds and syllables can fit together. For example, in English, you can't usually start the word with the sound ng, which is ng, although this is perfectly fine in isiZulu. And when the test words in an experiment don't match these rules, speakers don't have a strong sort of cross-sensory association. So an English speaker finds it hard to decide whether Srpski or S-R-P-S-K-I, if that makes sense, is spiky or round, because it doesn't sound like a word in our language. And there's also, these words also have meanings in other languages. So booba is a Romanian word that's used for a small child's wound, which could feel more like a spiky association for Romanian speakers. And kiki, which is pronounced more like gigi, means cute in Turkish, which could give that word associations with sort of a round-headed chubby babies or something like that. So This is an interesting study, and it does raise some questions about how speech emerged and why speech emerged at all, and the growing evidence that vocal noises can also evoke ideas like shape or size sort of helps to close to help us understand that question and may have played a significant role at the very core of language.
That was AUT Professor Marcus Jones speaking with Christina on this week's Dear Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.